In 2007, I was hired to work up north in a small Inuit village on the Hudson Bay coast. This experience taught me a lot, but one thing it made me very conscious of was water. Because of the permafrost in the north, most villages don't have a water and sewage system underground like we have in most Western cities. So each home has a tank. Actually, it has two tanks. It'll have a water tank and a sewage tank. The water tank will be filled most days, and the sewage tank will get emptied most days, sometimes not so reliably on the weekend. But they're not filled and emptied at the same time because it's separate teams and separate trucks that do the job. So the way that it works is that if either your sewage tank is full or your water tank is empty, the water stops working. And each house has two lights that will turn on if your water tank is getting empty or if your sewage tank is getting full. It's sort of like a warning light. So you can kind of manage your water supply by making sure that you watch these two lights on the wall and changing your behaviors. So what we did is we learned to do certain things to manage our water. So things like turning off the shower while soaping your body, or, you know, shampooing your hair so we wouldn't let the water run like we normally would, you know, in the city. And if the sewage light was on, we would do things like plug the bathtub drain so the water doesn't go in the sewage so that it doesn't fill up and the water stops working. Because you could be in the shower and all of a sudden there's no more water and you're full of soap. So often you're sharing the water in the sewage tank with other households because you'll either be in a unit, like in an apartment kind of complex with five other units, or you'll be in a house, but sort of more like a townhouse where you'll have two homes, so like two separate families, but they'll be sharing the water and the sewage. So you need to, you know, not just think of yourself and your own needs, but you also need to think that on the other side, there's another family that's using the water. When I would come back home for vacation, I was much more aware of how lucky we are to have running water and a sewage system, because water management is very labor intensive up north. Our guest today grew up in Burundi, where one of the daily chores was to go down the mountain to fill a container with water and bring it home for cooking, cleaning, and bathing. He had the reverse experience for mine, where he grew up in the countryside where everyone went to fetch water and bring it home, and visited the city for the first time just before going to high school and seeing that his uncle had endless water supply in his home. Unfortunately, along with the many experiences that he is grateful for, our guest also experienced a lot of violence, tragedy, and betrayal. Hi, and welcome to the Running Book Reviews podcast, where we review running books to help you decide if you would like to read the book for yourself. We also hope that listening to us chat about running can help keep you motivated about your own running, or maybe inspire you to try something new. My name is Liz, and with my co-host Alan, we're going to talk with author Gilbert Touabonnier about his book, The Voice in My Heart.
The Voice in My Heart is Gilbert Touabonnier's story of growing up in Burundi on a peaceful mountainside surrounded by family, discovering the sport of running as a child, and later being the only survivor of an attack on his school, where the Hutus killed many Tutsi teachers and students with machetes before putting those that were still alive in a building which they doused with gasoline and lit on fire. Gilbert was the only survivor of this attack, but was badly burned, and doctors told him that he probably wouldn't run again. During his recovery, Gilbert describes many emotions he had to deal with, like survivor's guilt, anger towards Hutu tribes, difficulty trusting people, and being constantly afraid that someone was going to poison him or kill him while he was trying to recover. The book is beautifully written, and the story is divided into seven chapters, called Deliver Us From Evil, Chapter 2, Education is Our Children's Future, Chapter 3, Acts of Contrition, 4, Rise to Glory, 5, Initiation and Advancement, 6, Recovery and Reflection, and 7, The Road Back. So before I introduce Gilbert, let me give you a little bit of background on Gilbert. Gilbert is a world-class runner who grew up in a small village in Burundi. He dominated the 400 and 800 meter events in scholastic track meets, and continued to have success in these disciplines as he grew up. He seemed to work very hard in school and was able to continue to high school, which is not that common in Burundi. Only a small percentage of students go on to university, and Gilbert was one of these. He's effectively a survivor of the massacres that are now labeled as the Burundian Civil War of the early 1990s. His event in 1993, I'm sure he'll talk to us a little bit about. It's described in detail in the book, and it's quite incredible. By 1996, his running skills had took him to the United States as part of an Olympic training program. He obtained a track scholarship at Abilene Christian University and was a national champion runner this school. He's the award-winning coach of Gilbert's Gazelles Training Group in Texas, Austin. In 2006, he co-founded the Gazelle Foundation, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to improve life for people in Burundi without regard for their tribal affiliations. Today, Gilbert is a U.S. citizen and lives in Austin, Texas with his wife and two children. Welcome to the podcast, Gilbert.
Thank you for a warm welcome.
I hope we did you justice.
You did a fantastic, a great job for, I didn't even remember my chapters in my book. So that's brilliant.
It's a nice revision for you then.
Yes, it is. Yes.
Okay, maybe we could launch in with our usual first question. And it's quite particular for you because some parts of the story must be quite stressful for you and a bit distressing for you. So what made you decide to, you know, commit it into a book? What made you decide to write the book and what do you hope that people will get out of the book, reading the book?
Thank you for the question. For a while, I hesitated to write, to tell my story to the rest of the world. I was encouraged by my friends because I was shy and I was still like in shock. I had a lot of scars. I didn't want to tell anyone what happened to me. I want to keep to myself. And I was encouraged by these three women that I was coaching. I was coaching them to run, and they found out in the race that I had a lot of scars, but I didn't tell them the story. But I won the race when the singlets, when someone would take a photo, then they started asking, what happened to you? And they helped me realize that I have a story to tell, and the world should listen, should know what happened to me. I should not be shy hiding. And I am glad I did, because what the book has done to not only promote and tell the story to what happened in 1993 in the school of Kibimba High School in the whole country. It's been great to be able to tell this story through the book. And also through the book, I was able to share the culture, the Burundi culture, the way I lived. And I'm so glad I did, because the foundation right now, which is focusing on providing clean water, it's been huge, because people read the book and they want to get involved, want to help, want to contribute to make a difference, to make a changes, to transform Burundi young community.
So not only has it helped you as a person, it's actually helped the cause in terms of bringing people to recognize and the needs of people in Burundi with respect to water and rally them to the cause.
Correct. Yes, we have seen donations and day after days because it's people read a book and they see what happened to me, and some of these problems still happen. Like kids are, you know, traveling miles before school to fetch water before school. And so give them a chance and a way to get engaged. Yes.
So I guess the first question is, there are two tribes that that you describe in the book. So the Tutsis, which is your tribe, and the Hutus. And there's been violence for decades between those two tribes. And I know that this is not like a quick question to answer, but maybe you can just give the listeners a little bit of a summary. Why have these two tribes been so violent towards each other for so many years?
It's not an easy task. It's not an easy answer, because if you look what we're fighting for, it's just power. Who wants to be in the power? And just manipulate the uneducated, the youth. Otherwise, if you think about the tribes, we're not a tribe. We speak the same language. We eat the same food. We have the same religions. It's not like there is a Muslim over this or if you look what it describes as a tribe, it is not a tribe. Look what we're fighting for and how long we've been fighting. It's just ridiculous. It should have stopped. And hopefully the new generation doesn't have to see moving forward. But the way it was manipulated during the colonization, you know, the Hutu, the Tutsi were in power and then overturned, and then they keep going back and forth. The main reason, because I've known people been searching and looking why the Hutu are fighting against the Tutsis, they're trying to dig deep. And because it used to be, when I was growing up, my parents, my grandmom was, because I didn't get a chance to see my granddad, but my grandma, who was kind of the leader, taught us how to love one another, even though she lost to her son due to a civil war. But she was always optimistic. She was always trying to teach us how to love and to love one another. I didn't see that intense. But you grow up, you're Tutsi, you're a Hutu. You look at the description, the nose, all those things, it's harder to pinpoint why this person is a Hutu, why this person is a Tutsi. And just, if you go back, it's a power. Who wants to be in power? Who wants to be in control? That's all.
So you actually described that your childhood was really peaceful, like you were surrounded by family, you guys all kind of live together. It doesn't seem like for the better part of your childhood that you really were too aware of all the fighting. So do you remember when you became aware of the violence and the tension between the two?
So when you were growing up, they would tell you, yeah, that's a Hutu family and that's a Tutsi family, but we were not attacking one another. We were living peacefully. And there was tension as I was growing up. I remember 1988, to take you back, my uncle was killed in 1972. And he was killed by Hutu. So they tell you he was killed by Hutu. But the society is so quiet and I would say secretive. They will not tell us exactly what happened. They died. But that's it. They don't tell you a lot. I guess they don't want us to stress out, or they don't want us to grow up with hate. At least that's what was my family. They want us, you know, if somebody died, if something happened, couldn't justify. But we were told it was killed by a Hutu. In 1988, when I was in high school, there was in the northern country, in northern of Burundi, there was some attack, even 91. But you hear they were talking about some robbers, but they were chased away, and that's it. That's what you hear. It's not like right now with social media, you get a chance to see live. And so I kind of knew, but I ignored it. I knew I treated everybody equal. I knew if someone was a Hutu, was a human being, we eat the same food. We didn't treat each other. We treated each other with respect. When it was a celebration, we could all celebrate together. When it was everything we did, there was no discrimination.
Yeah, I was going to say, because in the book you do mention like you have classmates that are Hutu, and you actually like there, you don't really put much importance on it for most of the book, just maybe the day that sort of changed your life, that day you mentioned you noticed that all the Hutu students were missing. And it was only the Tutsis, but up until then, I mean, it seemed like, you both had the same education, you were in the same classes, you did the same things, the same sports, you were on the same teams. I think you mentioned at one point that there were more Tutsis because the parents put much more importance on education. And I know that your parents put a lot of importance on education. They tried really hard to send you and your brother and sister to school as long as you could. why would you say that your parents valued education so much?
They value education because, especially my mother came from a family where they were all educated, her cousins and uncles, and they were all educated. It's my father's family where most people were like a business. Everybody wanted to do business. So my mother was always pushing us. And we have also had inspiration, leaders, people that inspired us, people to look up to, that done a great job, that done great for themselves and for the family because of education. So to go back to the question you asked about, I noticed the separation when they were taking us to a burning building. I had no clue who was a Hutu and a Tutsi. The only way you know it was when we started going to escape, we're trying to get together, make sure we don't leave anybody behind. That's where you notice, hey, this person is missing. I had no idea. They could have been hiding somewhere. But that triggered the question mark, where, the doubt. I never pay attention to that, because when it comes for a class or a sports, if you're lined up for 800 or 400, it doesn't matter who's lined up. It doesn't matter. I mean, you're just going to bring the baton first, or you're going to cross the finish line first. That was for me. So I never pay attention to those.
Let me wind you back first before we talk about, what happened at Lycée Kibemba. When you were very young, you seemed to be in a village which was very basic, very simple. And then you made the transition to sort of a big school. And suddenly you changed to, you were for the first time put in front of things that were like big city things. How is that for you? Like seeing electricity and water freely available, getting your first shoes. I think in the book you describe getting your first shoes at age 12. Something like that.
Yeah, that was exciting.
How was it suddenly going from a village with just family into all the things in cities, seeing motor cars and things that you'd never experienced before?
It was, I remember the moment. It was pretty exciting. In a village, but my routine was to get up in the morning and go fetch water, and then I run to school 6 miles away. Then I will come back home and do the same thing. I will fetch water. And then my parents, sometimes they will go, hey, son, we need you to go guide, collect the cows. And then I will go get the cows. And then by the time you've done all that, it was like almost 7 o'clock. And sometimes it will be milking the cows, make sure the small cows have been inside. Make sure that before you go to bed, everything been locked up. That was the routine. Then when I passed national test to go to a high school, which was starting in seventh grade, before I get to my school, was a boarding school, more than 600 students. Before I get there, I stop in the city with my uncle, and the city was overwhelming, cars everywhere, fear creeps in, because how am I going to cross this street? I used to have a street by myself. Now you have tons of cars, people screaming, yelling. You want to go to this quarter, you want to go to this quarter. And it's not like here also where you have lights that protect you. No, you find a moment when a car is, far away and you run, which is dangerous. And you get in a house, there's a switch for electricity. It was overwhelming. And then in the school, and my uncle took me to school. When I get to school, I used to live alone with my family. Now you've been assigned a bed. They have a double bed where you have one under and one up. You do what you've been told, and they set you to a routine. There's a small bed, double bed, one up and one down. So you where the toilets are, and they show you in the cafeteria and the classroom. To get used to that routine, it took a while, but everything was exciting. It was exciting in the sense that it helps the mind from here to there. And then in the cafeteria, when you finish eating, you wash your face, you wash your plate. And it got me a chance to be responsible a little bit, because you have to be responsible to the things you've been told to do. Show up on the time. Make up your bed before you go to class. Clean your plate after you finish eating. Those are the things that kids these days don't do. But that gave me a chance to be responsible. Also, making friends. I was able to make friends, the people I never seen before. I didn't know anyone going to that school. And that's a part of growth. So it was a growth moment for me. Yes.
I think there's one kind of curious thing that that you explained in the book, and it was, you know, you're not the oldest. You have an older brother, and he had gone through this experience where your uncle took him to his home. He experienced like having a shower for the first time. And, you know, he went through the same things that you went through. Like your uncle probably bought him his first uniform, his first shoes, and all those kinds of things. But yet, from what I understand, he didn't tell you anything. Why do you think he didn't tell you anything? Was it because he wanted you to like experience it for yourself, or do you think he just didn't know how to explain it because it was so different?
I think he did a little bit, but sometimes he left out some of his secret, because it's a nerve-wracking when you go to a new place, you don't know anyone, a different school. There used to be a hazing too. They mm-hmm. were hazing great. Didn't want to scare me. And also, we didn't attend the same school. It was not like I went to the school that he went to. He went in the city. And for me, I went way in the country. It was in the country, but compared to the capital, it's a country. And he didn't tell me much. He didn't tell me much. Part of it is not to scare me. And second, it was a different kind of culture. So he'd never been to my culture. But I mean, the excitement builds up. It was building up day after day. The anticipation, when am I going to get there? What's going to happen the first day? You can million thoughts going through my head, my mind, trying to figure out how I'm going to be able to live in an unknown city for the first time and make friends and be able to survive. Yes.
So when was it that you realized that you were quite a good runner? Because, you know, you've been running ever since you were small, but suddenly you realize you're quite good at this.
You know, my coach, who I love and admire today, inspired me to believe in myself. So I remember it was at the end of the semester, we were about to go home. And before we go home, we'll make sure we take care of the plants and make sure we weed out the garden. The school had some garden. And then there was a school activity that was organizing a race, kind of just to occupy students. There was a prize money. I begged my teacher to participate. She's like, she gave me a chore. She gave me a place to clean up and weed out. And before I could join, I'm doing like in seconds so I can go to this race. I showed up to the race, and everybody was ready to go. You remember seeing the movie, that kid who's late and just, you know, looking around. There's a lot of people know what to do and no shoes. I got online, and there's this guy, they said he's one of the best in the school. And I just look in his eyes, he looked my eyes. It's like part of his mind was like, what are you doing here? And I'm like, what are you doing here? I deserve it. It's that kind of talk, but talking among your, inside yourself. Anyway, they start the race. That was a 5 mile. Okay. Keep in mind, I was doing that going back and forth from my elementary school, the primary school. I was doing that. I was doing the double. So 5 mile was a piece of cake. So the first maybe kilometers, I am in front. I'm like, holy moly, what is going on here? I look back, nobody's close to me. And I kind of extended the lead, and I won the race by, I don't remember it was, but it was a long time. And when I won the race, my friends, a coach came up to me and he said, son, you're so good. You can be good, not only here, but all over the globe. And to me, the globe was my school. The globe was to beat everyone in my school, because I have no TV. Keep in mind, there's no TV. There is mm-hmm. no internet to search how good I am. I've heard some national athletes. That's what I want to be. The coach said, you can be the best. That word really is still up to today. Whenever I'm ready to tackle and do races, is always with me. I am good. And because of coach, I thank him for, his name is Adolf, who inspired me. Yes.
That's Adolf Rukenkanya.
Correct.
So he's a big influence on your life. Huh? He's the first person who said you could be a national class athlete.
Yes, he was great. He watched me, later on he put me with some of the best athletes. One of my teammates ended up winning a gold medal in the Olympics, 96 5000. His name is Venusti. And to see how we were like running a 800 and do also we call footing, like, you know, like long run, but it was not a long run. It was more like a tempos. And he would watch me, put me to test and figure out that I might be a good athlete. So that, but the word that they really inspire me, that's what it really, when you have someone that believes in you, that's amazing. That's incredible.
So did you have a problem with your family or your uncle or your mom with pursuing running versus pursuing whatever educational aspirations they had for you?
Yeah, so I hid this for a long time. I didn't tell my parents that I was a runner.
Okay.
I didn't tell my mama that I was a runner because what happened is they associate running with death, fear, because people go do marathons without not enough nutrition and, I mean, hydration also goes and something. And then most of the time people die, used to, because again, not eating enough or not being prepared. So my mother associated with, had that image. If you run, you're gonna die. Says, son, don't do it. The people in the city, my uncle knew that I was a runner. My brother knew that I was a runner, but never said a word to my mom. Until one day, they select the national team, and the way to alert and tell everyone, it's not like a mass email or something or social media blast. They went on a TV, national TV. The student from this school, Gilbert Tuhabonye from Kibimba, and they named the list, and she heard my name. It's like, son, you. Where are you going? I said, I'm going to the city to compete and to train. Yes, I will be back. I'll be back to for the family chores. I'll be back to fetch water. I'll be back to guard the cows. But I had to go because they paid everything. They paid the trip. They paid also the time we were training. So
that's amazing. So so that's that until then, I think was, you know, kind of like life was really good for you. You were excelling in school. You were running really well. And then one day you were supposed to have a big chemistry test and something horrible happened. So I don't know how you want to describe that day, but I'll leave it to you to tell us what happened that day.
Yeah. Before I start, I would like to say that the training camp that Mama heard didn't know that I was going to, had no warning. I came home with, they paid for my tuition for a whole year because of, we spent a lot of time and no helping the parents. So the whole tuition for a whole year was waived. It really was like, she didn't get mad. She's like, wait a minute. Yeah, that can save me. Maybe keep doing it. But 1993, October the 21st is a really sad day for me and also for the country. We lost a lot of people. Luckily, I survived. It was in the morning. I was really stressed out and nervous about tests because I wanted to go to college. And the only way to do it is study and pass the national exam. That morning was hard in so many levels. Couldn't sleep the night before. And every time I was trying to listen news before I go to class and the radio didn't work. And usually, you know, if the radio doesn't work and you know your batteries are not dead, that's a sign of a coup d'etat. And I ignored it because the most important for me was to know the material and be able to pass. Those were major tests, but you still have to have a test, national test. As I'm going back, my class was far away in the corner. As I'm going to my class, it was still pitch dark. I'm trying to, you know, the physics and the chemistry is, it's all about, it's all about formula. I'm trying to revise my formula in my head as I'm heading back to class. You know, it was odd. I didn't see that many students. Usually you see many people because the rumor started circulating. People heard from a radio, a neighbor in Rwanda, that the president was killed. So I went there. The class, there was not enough lights. We didn't have electricity that day. The lights were not enough coming to the class, classroom. So I went outside trying to put my book against the sun so I can see in the light area. And that's when I saw one of my teammates, used to be my teammates in 4x4. And he didn't say a word. I look at him and he just showed me like he was about to chop my head off. And I was, wait a minute, what is this? Tonight, it's like tonight. I mean, tonight, that's the message he was saying. And I ignored him again. And then right after, I saw a bunch of people coming to school with a machete and with a big sticks. And then there was one of my favorite, I think it was science drawing teacher. He came running. He was an athlete. Come running. He's like, man, they've been taking my roommates. Meaning the people that he lived with. They went to the teacher's kind of house and apartments and took every tutsi. And it's like, they're coming to school. We heard they're coming to school. So he stayed right with us. And things got worse because the student, the news traveled so fast. The student knew what happened. And we're trying to calm. I was in a, you know, senior kind of group. We're trying to help the students stay calm. And these people came straight to the campus with the sticks and they were wanting the professors. And someone said, hey, you are done. We are taking the professors and then we're going to come after the seniors and then I will come after the juniors and so on all the way. But we're going to start the growing up. And I heard that and I thought, this is not a joke. I said, our professors are gone. Now we're going to be next. What we do? Finally, the headmaster showed up. He showed up. And we went to ask him, what's going on? How are we going to stay safe? How are we going to be protected? And he just said, son, you are going to see what Jesus saw on the cross. I'm like, I'm shocked. I'm stumbling in the world. I'm trying to understand how in the world of parents, you know, when you take your kids to a boarding school, the headmaster, it's for everyone. It's for the Hutus, for the Tutsis, for all the kids, boys and girls, doesn't matter. And here he said, you are going to see what Jesus on the cross. The president is killed. You are going to see what Jesus saw on the cross. I'm like, why? They're going to hang us. I started going, oh my God, they're going to hang us. What are we going to do? What am I doing?
Do you think, and anybody at this point, like, were you guys all just really surprised that this was happening or did anybody run away?
You know, I don't know. It was hard because they surrounded the school. I mean, trying to run away was big. Because the thing happened at night in the nighttime while we're sleeping, they've been spending the whole morning. Later on, I found out who was orchestrating all these things, but I'm not going to say here. They have surrounded the school, making sure that nobody were trying to leave and escape. Yeah, some people knew, and I didn't know. Once again, I was not like nosy, trying to get into somebody's business. Mine was just, I came here to study. I'm going home with the grade. I'm kind of, That's it. So we decided to leave the school as a group, and that's where we were divided. The Hutu, we didn't even know where they went. And then the Tutsis, we ended up struggling how to go to a camp that was 26 kilometers. We trying to figure out how are we going to get there to the next camp. And we decided to go and walk peacefully, thinking nobody's going to attack us. And the whole mob went all around and got in front of us and making sure, like, let's say like a group is, I mean, we were surrounded and there was no way nobody's going to escape. And they cut machete. We got to a market after 2 kilometers. They stop. Somebody draw a line. It's like, you pass this on the sand. There was like draw a line on the sand. If you pass this, you dead. And I was in the front because I was like, you know what? We've done so great for the school. I've brought the champion trophies to the school. These people, I know them. They're not going to do anything. I mean, this is the first time we see this. They're not going to do that. We are trying to negotiate. And all of a sudden, this woman throw a spear right into my teammates. It poked whole knee, the quads. And then we all ran away. As I'm running, I was chased with, maybe 100 people were on me because I had a mission. The headmaster told them to get me first before I can reach out to the army, because he knew if I got a chance, I was going to reach out to the army. So they brought my back to school. As we going back to school, they were chopping, you know, kind of kids and beating them. And we got to a place where it was like a checkpoint. The headmaster had to make sure before they can take you to fire, you were a Tutsi. There were no mistakes. And I arrived and they clapped and then they like put him in a, you know, in a special building. I'm going to come after him. They put him in a room. They put me in a room and they locked the building. I'm looking a way to escape. There's no way to escape. And the mob outside is going nuts. They're like, bring Gilbert, bring Gilbert. So they brought me back, put him in the middle. They wrapped me with other student. I was pulling, you know, 11 people to my left, 11 people to my right. They're making sure that I don't escape. And as we're heading to walk in, they started taking our clothes. If you had a nice shoes, they take your shoes. If you have a nice pants, they say, give to me. They would take the pants. And they took us to this place. There was no way. It was like surrounded. It was planned. It was not something just happened. It was planning. Someone was executing the plan. And we got there. You had a choice either to die in the fire or they kill you in the places. They chop you in the places. The whole time I had a peace of mind. The whole time I was like, I will escape. I will tell the story. And I heard a voice tell me, nothing will happen to you, son. Be calm and don't do it. Do not try to run away. The message was like, man, I will save you. Don't worry. It's going to be all right. But I couldn't tell what that comfort that was coming from. And then we get outside the building. This kid, I will never forget. His dad was a general in the army. He said, no, I'm not going. So they chopped him in front of me. And then fear and I was scared, I jumped into the building. And the building, they formed some kind of semicircle where it's like creating a funnel. When someone misses you, this one will hit you. And they were using this stick and with the words in Imbonugutu, which means they're going to, it's like a kill. There's no, just kill. So they were hit me here in the chest. And I got in the fire. I got in the building. And when I got in the building, most everybody was almost dead because they'd been beaten up. And for me, besides the hit, everything else was fine. And that was a way to survive. I was like, you know what? Dying, I don't have a choice. I'm going to fight from inside. If someone comes trying to find me inside, I'm going to defend myself. I find a soldier who was still alive. We fought through the night trying to prevent the people coming to finish their horrible massacre plan. Luckily, after 8 hours, I couldn't take it. I broke the window. I used a someone that I know, a dead body, because there's no point. There's no other option. And I landed at outside. And to be honest with you, I thought if I land outside, if they chop my head off, at least my parents would come to bury the head. That was the plan. I didn't have a plan that I would escape. And then when I land outside, and to me, that's a miracle, because I don't know how I escaped that place. I don't know how they didn't see me. They noticed some kind of fire after I jumped off. I started running and they chased me. It was in the night, it was dark. It was the downhill. They gave up. They thought I was gonna die because I was in the fire, but I heard them, I overheard them. And that gave me a chance to start a rescue. I gave me a chance to walk through the night, trying to figure out, find out a place that is safe. Also, as I'm walking, I end up in a group of women and the children, because what these men would do, they would go kill and then they hide their families. And I end up in these families, and there's a man who knew who I was. He was one of the person guiding the house. And he's already made his way to his house to protect his family. I end up there. For the first time, I denied my tribe. I'm like, no, they made a mistake. They made me go because I am a mix. My mom is a Tutsi, but my dad is a Hutu. But that was all I, just because I want to survive. I want to get out. And this woman said, son, this is really strange. They measured my forehead. I'm like, where are they looking at my forehead? They measured my hands, look at the vein. It's like, and then they said, show me your finger. They measure also my my ankle. The thing that I used to do with the Jews. And I'm like, how in the world this is associated? Because I remember seeing this sign in history. The men decided to hang me. They decided to crucify me. They went to get woods so they can hang me. But the woman gave me the water. I didn't trust her though. She's like, I'll give you your water, kids, and I'll give you a jacket. My back was in a mess. There was no place to put a clothes. And she's like, go. She showed me a way to go. While the husband were out there looking for woods and to crucify me, because they said, I know these kids. He escaped. He ran away. We got to kill him. And the mother left me go and told me where to go in the hospital where there was some student. And as I'm running naked, I ran into another group. They thought I was kind of some evil, and they let me go, some ghost. They thought it was a ghost. They let me go. And no, they didn't see. They saw something running and they chased it. And I end up in the maternity room. And finally, I able to find a student. Most of the girls, these girls were like broken ankles. They broke the ankle things, said they come to marry them. And time was going so fast. It was around 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock in the morning. The soldiers were able to find out what happened. And I overheard them as they rescued student. They said, hey, we heard the famous athletes has been killed. He's like, yeah, was the first person to get killed. And I overheard them and I got up the window. I said, no, I'm here. I'm still alive. And there were tears. The guy who rescued me, I knew who it was. And he came and it was from my village. We were in the sixth grade together. And but he chose the army. And here he rescued me. And they took us in the bus to a army camp where they guide us while they're trying to find our families. And I was still in the shock, but at the same time, my pain was not worse for some of the other ones. And we spent a couple weeks in this camp Moaro, where the chief of command was, I knew he was. His wife was from my area. I asked if they can help me locate my family, tell them that I'm alive. And I found out that my parents, after they heard the radio, they started doing a funeral ceremony because they heard that every student at Kibimba that was dead. They started doing a funeral. And I asked, Lucy is her name. I asked the to contact my family. She was able to locate my family. My brother came to get me and they transferred me to hospital. That's after 7 days. Mm-hmm. They transferred me to a hospital nearby where I grew up, where I was surrounded by people that I'm familiar, people that I know. And then after, when I was in hospital, I was told that I would never run again. And the doctor looked at my scar, it was 30 degree burn. My back was a mess. My legs were a mess, 30 degree. Like, this kid will never run, no matter how hopeful he is, he would never run. But I was determined. I was determined to get back to running. And in fact, when I was in hospital, I received a letter. This letter was inviting me to run on a full scholarship here in the United States. I was like, wait a minute. Someone out there believe I can do it. And that gave me a chance to do crazy stuff. I was determined to get back to running, and I started doing the therapy. That whole 94, beginning of 94, I spent my time.
I think it's worth highlighting because, you know, you just described how you had to run all the way from your school to escape, and you ran like through a town and you ran to a hospital, and so you ran all this way and you escaped. But I mean, you ran with like pretty severe injuries. Probably you had no idea even at this point how bad your injuries were and how long it would take you to recover after that.
I guess you probably just had so much adrenaline in your system, you didn't realize how injured you were, maybe.
Yes, I had no idea. The fact also was I knew I was in a danger zone. I knew that if I don't get up quick, even if I have to crawl, actually it was not that much running, friends. It was like a run and a hide or walk, a hide, because every move in the dark, I don't know if you've been in the dark and a area full of coffee plantation, every tree we move, I think, is a people, because it was not electricity. I was going through the woods, just using my memory, place I have been. And I had no clue exactly how bad the burn was. That is true. Until when I was at the hospital, like, hey, kid, you have a third degree burn. You have lost 30% of your body. That's how I know. Otherwise, you're right. I had no clue.
I guess physically, you've got a huge challenge there. I think it was Tulane University who sent you a scholarship. They didn't know that you were injured at this point. They thought you were fully healthy and ready to race. And then you've got, like, mentally, how do you cope as well? So you've got the physical difficulty. You've got to try to rehabilitate somehow. And mentally, you've also got to keep yourself together, which must be quite difficult. How did you do all of this?
It was very tough because while I'm still recuperating, I would see, I lost faith in the people, because the people that are trying to kill me, they were my friends, they were my headmaster. I lost trust. And at that point, it was really hard to trust anyone. You know, the people would come to see me, priests and the head of like bishops and student, they came to see in a hospital the famous person being burned, the famous runner being burned alive. It was the first time that the hospital that treated me, Bururi Hospital, to treat burns, which was just I was getting shots twice a day, pretty much. And people will come to see me from a different background. But I struggle mental to let it go, to forgive the people, because there were still killings. And if you look with the killings, people would hide behind their religions to go kill people. Who else goes in the church with a machete in the pocket? And what kind of religion is that? And to me, I had to find a solution. And the solution was, how in the world I'm going to be able to live peaceful, and how I'm going to forgive the people. I read the Bible, trying to understand, trying to clear my head and making sure that I find the right answer, which was to forgive and move on. And that gave me the courage to really do great things. And it was not enough. It was really tough. Running was another vehicle that really got me. After I started doing the rehabbing, I feel so great. As I'm walking to market, walking to places, I felt great every day by moving. The movement started and I felt great. And that gave me hope to start a training. And 95, I started competing. And by 96, I was in the top shape.
I mean, I remember you explaining how you had gone to see your coach, Adolf, sort of during your rehab. It seemed like almost like he was a little bit sad, you know, because he was happy you were alive, but he was sad because like you weren't running. And then one day you go and see him and you ask him to time you on the track. So how did that feel?
It felt like I had something to give. I mean, to prove, because what I was all the time, I was very, very competitive. I still am competitive to myself and also like to compete with others. So they organized a race and the race was to represent the country 95. And I was like, maybe I should try, but I'm not going to try 800 because 800 requires training. I'm not going to try 400. And I tried 400. I won, but they didn't want to take me. Because I had a bloody feet. Who take it to a champion, a bloody feet where they have like, they're trying to sabotage my trip. And I was determined to fight for, and my coach was sad, but I was also happy and rejoiced because we were able to reunite again, started training again. And he knew what kind of mental strength that I have. And it was a great moment to be able to put one foot in front of the other and to hear the man who has told you, you can be great again. It was just like confirming my doubt was someone that you don't need to doubt yourself. I am here for you, kid. I am going to help you, kid. Because he knew my strength. Yeah.
And as part of your comeback, you got invited to go to a training camp just ahead of the Atlanta Olympics. You got invited to go to the USA, which was sort of almost a dream that you have of going there. And off you go to training camp there. Did you realize when you went to training camp that in the USA, that you might be in the USA for a long time?
Long term, how long? I knew that I want to study and I knew I want to train and go back. I know. I didn't know that I would be here this long. After I started training and joined the climb at LaGrange, the camp was LaGrange in Georgia, which was like 60 miles from Atlanta. And started taking the classes and ESL classes, learning English. And because one of the goals was to attend the colleges here and run for the universities. It was always a goal of mine since I was a young boy. In fact, my teammates, I have a lot of friends that are in Canada, my teammates, and they used to laugh at me. Now, actually, we laugh at now because during a long run, we sing. It's not here with boring. During a long run, we sing. And singing was more like attacking one another, just fun stuff, making fun of each other, laughing, associated with the music. One of my songs, my friend, his name is also Gilbert, reminded me, he's like, man, you knew you're going to be in America because every song was like, USA to Zohadra, which means I am going to USA and look what I am. Yeah. So
you made a whole life for yourself because you got to bring your wife eventually. To the U.S. But how did you maintain the relationship with her between the time that you went to the U.S. and the time that you were able to bring her? Because there were a few years in between, I think.
Yes, I came in 96 and she joined 4 years later. What happened was I missed her daily, but also it was great because I didn't have a lot of distraction because coming to a new country and if you have too many goals, it can be challenging. But one goal was to get the job done, get established, get education, and stay focused and do well in athletics, and everything will come. So 2000, I went home in 99 and we saw each other. And it was just a hope that one day she would join me. Because it's not easy. It's not just like You can't just say, come over. It's not that, you know how it works. But it was challenging at the first because of communication.
No internet in 96.
Yes. 96, 97 was rough.
There was no FaceTime.
no FaceTime. You would call using like $10. You were speaking for 2 minutes. Sometimes the connection would take all your money. It was rough. And I didn't have much either, you know? And but through perseverance and trust and belief, she was able to join me. And we've been married since 2001. We have two beautiful girls. One is in college, just finishing, going to junior. And I also have a junior in high school.
That's Emma and Grace.
Emma and Grace, right. Yes.
So I guess congratulations are to also thanks to Abilene Christian University for offering you a full scholarship.
I deserve it. I earned it too.
You probably earned it several times over, Gilbert, but congratulations for the people who gave it to you too.
No, seriously. If I have to be really thankful for Abilene Christian University. There were so many colleges I could choose to, but I chose Abilene. It was small, in the midst of nowhere. I mean, they walk you on a campus. It's like you have this tradition of winning. And Abilene Christian University had, you know, up to today, top five, the school that has most championship in the whole colleges in the United States. It's unbelievable. Most people don't know. And I look at the tradition. I look at the people. I look what I want to accomplish. This is the place I want to be. And it's been great. I was able to win the national champion in 800. I want more, but I end up winning once. And so many things happened that when I was in Abilene. And the success that I had at Abilene Christian University led me to move here to Austin, which is right now, Austin is my second home and I love it. It's an active city, people run, and that's what I love to do, and just beautiful.
And you founded your training group and the Gazelle Foundation while you were in Austin.
Yes, through running, I was able to meet incredible people that they noticed my talent. And I like to give the time and the talents. One of my friends was coming from Africa and Ethiopia for Habitat for Humanity. And he came back. He's like, Gilbert, I went to Africa to do something to build houses. You should do this for your country. And and the book also came up. When the book came up, I started thinking a way to, you know, what can we do? What's the next? And 2006, the book came out. In 2007, you know, Paul and Peter out of 22 miles, you know, when you're running 22 miles with guys, you're just talking and talking. And this guy, Peter, he's, you know, the Gazelle Foundation was born. And through the Gazelle Foundation, the work that we do is really remarkable. And I think if it wasn't started the Gazelle, the running group, the Gazelle Foundation, I don't think the Gazelle Foundation will be here. Because the people that I meet, that inspire me every single day, that I pushes me every day. It's been a nice and ride to be able to meet these incredible leaders and in our community, and it's been great.
So you raise funds for to help bring water to families in Burundi. Is this the main objective?
Yes. So remember I told you the story, my routine was to fetch water every morning and that's the way people still live. And with the Gazelle Foundation, I cannot tell you how proud and happy I am to be. More than 110,000 are getting clean water. In fact, one county of Songa, my native county, everyone, Hutu, Tutsi, Twa, had water. And it's something that warms my heart because water is a life. It's water here, we take it for granted. Mm-hmm. We forget that someone get up in the morning and don't have a clean water. And if you go to our website, gazellefoundation.com, and you look the photo, when the people see the water for the first time, or when the people get the water close to homes, the joy, the happiness, because it changes a life. Mm-hmm. And you know what? It's not that also that hard. It takes like $25 to give a life for someone, for the family. And it's been really rewarding to see the transformation happening. Right now we are in another county called Matana, which is a neighboring county. And works are doing great. It's something that really brings me joy and happiness, because to see the transformation that happening.
So if any of our listeners want to help or contribute, do they go to the gazellefoundation.com? Can they make a contribution or help via that website?
Yes, gazellefoundation.com. They can find the way to donate. We also host a race. I know Canadian, our neighbors, like to compete. We have a perfect...
We do. We do. We love to compete.
I know Canadians, my neighbors, they love to compete. We have a race in November 7th. It's a 10 mile. Hopefully things will be settled and we can have more Canadian run the race. That's another way. Because run what we do for that run for the water, the money raised is to send to build wells. So you register, somebody's going to get a clean water. So the more people register, the more people get a clean water. You will have a chance to visit Austin, beautiful city of Austin. But right now, go to the website and donate for a great cause. You are changing the life of someone. And I mean it, because think about what we do for water. Think about when I was going to school, wasting time fetching water, and I had to walk 6 miles to school. Just think about it. The thing you can do when you get home and you don't have water, what will you do? And the next water is just 5 miles away. Mm-hmm. And that kind of life, it's really remarkable.
All that because of a long run and an idea was born.
That is right. Running. I tell people that running has changed my life forever. If I don't run, I'm a different person, because running brought me back to life. Running has connected me. Look at you, through Jessica. Look how mm-hmm. you guys, if that's how you found my book. And by mm-hmm. the way, you don't think I know you. I've seen some of your reviews of the book you have reviewed. You are remarkable. You're a great storyteller. You help us understand, most of us, and be able to read the book through your show, to your podcast. And I appreciate and I thank you.
Oh, thank you.
No, really, you do a great job. I didn't say earlier, but I knew, and I've been reading and I follow you. I don't know how I didn't know you before, but my point is, running is my therapy, brings me joy, connects to people. Look at you. That's how I connect to you guys. And that long run led up to something bigger, and that is making a difference in Burundi.
That's wonderful.
Have you ever had a chance to go back recently?
Last time I went was 2011. I'm hopefully in a year or two, I might be able to go and just to check and see the transformation, be able to visit the people that we serve, be able to talk to them and hear from them the transformation. It's very easy and cheesy to tell you water is a transformation, but it's a different when you go here and the list of someone you have changed in life. Mm-hmm. It's one goal of mine to be able to do that.
Well, that's fantastic. We wish you every success with that. I guess also we should ask if you have a preference, if people want to buy your book, where they should get your book from.
I think you can get it from Amazon. It's probably the best thing. But if you want to sign, if you want the book signed, you have to order through the Gazelle Foundation.
Ah, fantastic. So we'll post that in the notes so that people can go to the Gazelle Foundation if they want a signed copy.
Yes, and plan to come run in November 7th, Run for the Water. It's a great event. I know you, Montreal, you have a Burundi drumming. We have a drumming at the finish line, and it's a unique race. It's a unique race. Take a look, take a peek and look at the race. It's really...
We didn't talk about your drumming ability. I saw that on YouTube. That looks like a pretty difficult task, much more difficult than running.
No, you know what? Actually, it was great. It helps, you know, now I know it helps the brain. I remember you have to not only memorize your lane, you also have to memorize. And when someone jumps, there is you have to act quick, reflection. It's a really good help in the reflection. And you also be creative, creativity, pay attention to the details, memorization. I mean, all of the above in the drumming. Because it was great.
Yeah, we also have to balance a huge drum on your head while you're doing all of this. Mm-hmm. It's crazy.
Yeah. No, the entrance to performance scene is always hard because we have to march with. It's pretty cool. Don't bring it up. I get excited. It's like, yeah, I miss it.
Yeah, so if anybody's curious and wants to have something to look up on YouTube, you can look up, I think I had just searched Burundi drumming or something along those lines. And it comes up with, you'll get to see it's a group dance with these big drums on that they're carrying around, and they're dancing at the same time, and they've got rhythm, and it's really amazing, actually.
It's totally crazy.
Actually, in your city, in Montreal, there is a good group that from Burundi descent that they perform. You should check them out. They're really, really good. It's one of the best in all over. They're really good.
We'll keep our eye out for that.
Maybe we should give our overview of what we thought of the book.
Yeah, we'll just give our summary thoughts on the book, and then we'll let you get back to your family.
Thank you.
Yeah, just in terms of summary for the book, first of all, the book is fabulously written. You know, when you read it, you know that it's been superbly well written. The detail of how much detail there is in the descriptions and the emotion that you feel kind of draws you into the story. I think this history that I didn't know, and probably most people wouldn't know, and culture that I didn't know, and the very best things that humanity have to offer, and to some extent, the very worst things that humanity can offer us. To walk in your footsteps, Gilbert, when you're a young boy discovering the world and the joy of running, was fantastic, and it was very able to do that through the book. But because of the detail also, I lived the atrocities of the genocide in Burundi, which was, you know, a shocking but amazing experience. Some people have these amazing stories, they don't know how to tell them very well, but this is not the case. If you pick up this book and you start to read, you'll be hooked. Whether you're a runner or you're not a runner, it's kind of irrelevant. I would say just to our listeners, just trust me, buy this book, read it, and you will be changed in some way.
I will kind of echo what Alan said. I mean, super well written. And you can feel how much Gilbert loves his country, his upbringing, his culture. And you almost feel the sadness when, you know, after what happened, when he kind of, you know, realizes that he can't go back while he's in the US. And it's almost heartbreaking because he grew up in a loving family, and he just, like, he had so many great experiences up until then. Yeah, it's a great book. It's a good read. I think runners will particularly love it because there is running in it. But like Alan said, anybody can pick up this book, and you'll definitely feel all the same feelings. There's a lot to learn about life in another country where people work very hard to have things that we take for granted. So that's kind of, it opens your eyes to what it's like. You know, we take things for granted, like running water, transportation, ability to choose which school you go to. So we didn't really talk about this, but Gilbert didn't get to choose which school he ended up in. He did a test, and based on the test, they sent him to the school that he went to. And, you know, here in North America, I mean, you know, you have choice. Anybody that likes to read memoirs or read biographies, I think you will love this book.
No, thank you. Thank you so much for that's kind of you. When I wrote the book once again, and I look back, What kind of person should read this book? This book for everyone. This book is for anybody that needs motivation. In a life, we fell down. In a life, something happened. But the key is, how do you bounce back? What do we tell our children about overcoming obstacles? This is the book that really it tells about overcoming obstacles. Think about me, I almost died, I almost lost my life, I lost my classmate, but yet I able to discover joy because I forget what happened and I move on. Think about a corona, what it's done in, to our life and to our neighbors and friends. And last year it was very hard and still people still shock. Now, what gets you going? What bring you hope? What bring you positive in life? For me, I have found running to be in a vehicle that helped me clear my head, clear my mind so I can run, so I can do the things that I love to do. I forgot to mention that I just received one of the greatest honor to be featured in a President Bush book where I was recognized as one of 43 immigrants that are making a huge difference in the life of the people. And it's huge. You'll be able to see it too. So anyway, I didn't want to leave that. I want to plug it in because it just happened. And so thank you so much.
Thank you, Gilbert. It's an absolute honor to sit and listen to you. And thank you for pouring your heart into the book that we're able to read.
Thank you.
So thank you for listening to another episode of Running Book Reviews. A big thank you to the publisher, Amistad, for providing review copies and also putting us in touch with Gilbert. Also, a big thank you to our friend, Jessica Call, who trained with Gilbert in Austin and gave us the recommendation for the book. A big thank you to Gilbert for spending time with us today. If you'd like to leave us feedback about how we can improve the podcast or you want to suggest a book that you'd like us to review in a future episode, please leave us a comment on social media. We are Running Book Reviews on Facebook and Instagram, and on Twitter we are reviews_running. Please also follow us on social media to find out about new episodes when they are released, or you can just subscribe to the podcast on your favorite streaming platform. That's all from Running Book Reviews.
Bye for now.